community that is unstoppable. We understand this critical history, a lot of it shaped by progressive academics like Bruce Cummings and the generations that he's taught, Susie Kim, J.J. Saw, the list goes on. And now there's another generation of academics that are teaching this critical history. I think that what we're trying to do is challenge the official narrative that the Korean War is a victorious war, that North Korea is bad and South Korea is good, when in fact it is so much more complicated. And I think the U.S. still has to atone for a lot of its misdeeds in the past century, whether it's the division of Korea without consulting a single Korean, the brutal military occupation that basically put into power the Koreans that had collaborated with the Japanese during occupation, you know, participating and overseeing massacres like the Jeju third, Sasam, what's called Sasam massacre that killed up to 80,000 people on that island, basically using the Cold War to quash, arrest, detain, imprison, and even murder those who had any kind of progressive values, whether it's trade union rights or worker rights or gender equality, to be cast as communists. You know, the Cold War was fought on the front line. And here we are, 70 years today, because the war never ended, we're in a new Cold War.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Professor Bruce Cummings of the University of Chicago, a history professor there and an expert on Korea. The USS Kentucky became the first U.S. nuclear-armed submarine to come to South Korea since the 1980s. Your response to why, especially now with the Biden administration, there is this this renewal of confrontations with North Korea?
Well, it's really not a renewal. It's just using a different instrument to carry out nuclear blackmail against North Korea. Every president for, going back decades has sent nuclear-capable bombers near Korean waters. Obama did it a lot, Trump, Biden. And the arrival of a nuclear submarine is, something that hasn't happened for 40 years, and it gains attention. But it's just part and parcel of the nuclear threats that the U.S. has mounted against North Korea. Since the armistice, itself was ensconced in a kind of cocoon of nuclear blackmail by the Eisenhower administration and Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. They made a big show of threatening North Korea and China with nuclear weapons. They made a big show of blowing off the first nuclear cannon in Nevada, which was on the front pages of many newspapers in the U.S. in May 1953. That cannon shot a 10-kiloton nuclear warhead, about half the size of the Hiroshima bomb. They detonated an enormous nuclear weapon in the Nevada desert. Around the same time, some people thought it was a hydrogen bomb. It wasn't, but it was the time when the U.S. and the Soviet Union were doing atmospheric testing of enormous weapons. Dean Rusk, as Christine said, became Secretary of State under the Kennedy administration, and he looked through the files to see if these nuclear threats actually brought North Korea and China to the point of signing the armistice, and he concluded that it didn't. And Eisenhower himself later said that this was mostly for show, and he had to kind of control Dulles, who was always talking about massive retaliation and the use of nuclear weapons. North Korea had no nuclear weapons from that point until 2006, and yet the U.S. consistently threatened North Korea with nuclear weapons. Dulles also masterminded the emplacement of tactical nuclear weapons in South Korea in January 1958, Honest John missiles, tactical nuclear weapons of other types. Soon, even backpack nukes, which weigh about 60 pounds, and one soldier can carry them and place them around any place north of Seoul or near the DMZ. George H.W. Bush took those nuclear weapons out of South Korea as part of a general drawdown of those weapons on a world scale. But the U.S. has continued to, as I said earlier, to threaten North Korea with nuclear weapons. And it's just game theory or deterrence theory 101 that after you threaten a small country with nuclear weapons long enough, they're going to go for their own. But I have to say, it's always the media attention on North Korea firing off a missile or blowing off an atomic bomb, and almost never any attention to this decades-long history of American nuclear blackmail.
Professor Cummings, the Yale University historian Samuel Moyne has said the Korean War was, quote, the most brutal war of the 20th century measured by the intensity of violence and per capita civilian death. Yet the Korean War is also called the forgotten war. You've said it's more of an unknown war. So as we begin to wrap up, if you can talk about where that leads, where you feel it should lead the U.S. today, and the impacts of the sanctions on North Korea, especially on the humanitarian situation on the ground there.
Well, what Professor Moyne is saying is exactly right, and I have to say it's also not anything new. A revisionist historian on the Vietnam War back, I think, in 1979, published a book where he said that civilian casualties— he had a table. Civilian casualties in Vietnam were 40% of all casualties. And then you look at Korea, 70% of all casualties, which I think is right. He didn't bother to comment on that. It was an unbelievably dirty war, with the U.S. Air Force razing every North Korean city to the ground. The U.S. Air Force ran out of targets within a couple of months, but kept pounding North Korea for 3 years. And this came from the highest level. Robert Lovett, the defense secretary under Eisenhower, said we should just continue to go on tearing this place up. It'll make it very hard for those people. So it was a kind of genocidal air campaign accompanied by massacres of political massacres of ordinary citizens, especially by South Korea, but also by American soldiers from time to time. So easily the dirtiest war of the 20th century in terms of major wars, much worse than Vietnam, which I think will surprise many people.
And Professor Cummings, we only have about a minute left, but I was wondering, you've also said that the Korean War inaugurated the U.S. military-industrial complex. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, Harry Truman went into the war with a defense budget of $13.5 billion. And within 6 months, he had $56 billion. In other words, a quadrupling of defense expenditures to the highest point ever until George Bush exceeded it in 2008. Just an enormous defense budget at a time when the American GDP was much smaller. So defense was about 3%, I believe, maybe 4% of GDP during and after the Korean War, compared to a much smaller percentage today or in 2008. The Korean War established a national security state at home, a CIA with so much money they didn't know what to do with it, so they tried to overthrow regimes in Guatemala and Iran in 1953 and 54. and we established for the first time military bases across the globe, more than 900 today, which most Americans know nothing about. It's an archipelago of empire surrounding, especially China, but we have an Africa command. I mean, it's just all over the place. And all of this got going not with World War II, when Roosevelt wanted to demobilize, and Truman continued that for a couple of years, but with the Korean War.
Well, Bruce Cummings, we want to thank you so much for being with us. History professor at University of Chicago, author of several books on Korea, including Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History in North Korea, Another Country. And we want to thank Christine Ahn, founder and executive director of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War, also coordinator of the Korea Peace Now campaign. Up next, an eyewitness to the assassination of Malcolm X reveals for the first time he overheard a New York police officer ask about one of Malcolm's assassins. Is he with us? Stay with us.
my time, I've suffered great pain.
How Long Must I Wonder by Nina Simone. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to look at the assassination of Malcolm X, shot dead inside the Audubon Ballroom February 21st, 1965. On Tuesday, a witness to the assassination revealed for the first time he overheard a New York police officer asking about Malcolm's assassin. Is he with us? The eyewitness, Mustafa Hassan, spoke Tuesday alongside Malcolm's daughter, Ilyasa Shabazz, and civil rights attorney Ben Crump at a news conference at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center, housed in the former Audubon Ballroom. In February, the Shabazz family announced plans to file a $100 million wrongful death lawsuit against a number of institutions, including the FBI, the CIA, the New York Police Department, concealing evidence of their involvement in the assassination. At the time of Malcolm's assassination, Mustafa Hassan was a member of the OAAU, that's the Organization of Afro-American Unity, part of Malcolm's security detail. Hassan later fled the country fearing for his life. He described what happened inside and outside the ballroom when Malcolm was shot.
There was a loud explosion that immediately caused further disruption, capturing everyone's attention. Now, a series of gunshots, number 10, then rang out from another direction, and I immediately ran from my post in the entrance and witnessed Malcolm X being shot. Number 11, I immediately started to make my way from the back of the Audubon, where I had been posted, and towards the stage where Malcolm X was located. However, the scene became chaotic as people frantically ran around seeking exits to cover and protect themselves. Number 12, I saw a man running down the aisle towards the exit where I had been posted with a gun in his hand. I made the decision to attempt to stop this person because he had a gun in his hand and was heading directly towards me. Number 13, I managed to knock this person down, and I continued towards the stage where Malcolm X was lying on his back, surrounded by his followers. I know now that the identity of the man with the gun is Talmage X. Hayer, also known as Thomas Hagen. When I arrived at the stage, I saw that Malcolm X was in grave condition, seemingly close to death, and as a result, my extreme distress and anger, I turned attention back to the man who I had seen running away, knowing that he had a part of responsibility for what I had just witnessed. Number 16. I would later see the same man outside as he was being beaten by Malcolm's followers, while a group of policemen who suddenly showed up on the scene asked if he was with us, while at the same time holding back Malcolm's followers from beating him.
Can you repeat that?
Yes. I would later see the same man outside as he was being beaten by Malcolm's followers, while a group of policemen who suddenly showed up on the scene asking, is he with us?
That was Mustafa Hassan reading from his own affidavit. He was inside the Audubon Ballroom when Malcolm X was assassinated 58 years ago, 1965. During Tuesday's news conference, I had a chance to question Mustafa Hassan.
Did you ever approach the police or the FBI, the authorities, to share what you had seen?
No. No.
Because?
Because
they had just killed Malcolm. terrorism trauma?
Because in my belief, they were the perpetrators. And they knew more than I did as a consequence of being the perpetrators of the event. Why would I go to them? And for whatever reason they called me, as the attorney stated, the reason that they failed to call me would have been that my testimony would have changed the outcome of the trial.
I got some more questions.
It would have pointed a finger of guilt at the establishment.
That was Mustafa Hassan speaking Tuesday about the assassination of Malcolm X. Three men were later convicted of killing Malcolm X. One was Talmadge Hayer, the man Mustafa saw shoot Malcolm. Two other men, Khalil Islam and Muhammad Aziz, were arrested and imprisoned for decades after being falsely accused. In 2021, the two of them were exonerated. By then, Khalil Islam had already died and Muhammad Aziz was 83 years old. We're joined now by civil rights attorney Ben Crump, representing Malcolm X's family. Ben, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of this testimony for the first time being heard, this eyewitness account of Mustafa Hassan, and where this fits into the lawsuit you'll be filing.
Well, thank you for having me, Amy. And thank you for being at the press conference. Mustafa Hassan's testimony for the first time in 58 years is astonishing, especially the level of detail that he chronicled that was corroborated by the photographs as well as the stock video that when the convicted murderer, Talmadge X, was being manhandled by Malcolm's supporters who had just witnessed him kill Malcolm X or shoot Malcolm X. The police ran up and they were asking, is he with us? And then as Mr. Mustafa Hassan believes, they were trying to help get him away where he could escape from the black supporters of Malcolm who was trying to make sure that he was captured. And so Mustafa, and you see it in the photographs, grabs onto his collar very tightly. And the police seem, as the photographs suggest, to be trying to separate him from the person who they had just saw shoot Malcolm. And this is Mustafa's belief, and when he puts it in context that the police are saying, is he with us, it suggests to him that the police were involved. Now, Amy, this is what we are arguing is completely new evidence that has never been presented before, this new information, and the fact that we know fraudulent concealment is a theory that will allow us to toll the statute of limitations and for Malcolm's family to have a chance at getting some measure of justice after all these years, because we know that the government concealed the fact that they had multiple informants in the Audubon Ballroom on May 21st, 1965, when Malcolm was assassinated. So essentially, those informants were kept isolated. Those New York Police Department undercover officers like Eugene Roberts and Ray Woods were all kept isolated from one another. And the police, we believe, knew when they arrived on the scene that they had undercover informants in there. And they didn't know what their assignments were, and they didn't know who they were, but they were told some of the black people are undercover informants, and that is why Mr. Hassan said they were saying, is he with us?
Well, Benjamin Crump, why has it taken over 58 years for this to come forward? Could you tell us a little bit about who Mustafa Hassan is and perhaps why he was never questioned?
Well, obviously, he was a young man who believed in the principles and philosophies of Malcolm X. He was a member of the OAAU, and he was a person who believed that black people had a right to self-determination and that the American government could not continue to oppress us and deny us liberty. And so after they killed Malcolm, like so many people in America, especially black Americans, who believed in the principles that Malcolm X was trying to articulate to the world, that he left America. And for not just his personal safety, but his family's safety. And as he stated, he was worried about where America was headed to as a society. And so he left for months, came back, and saw that they were having this trial. The police never approached him. The prosecutors never approached him. He was readily identifiable on all the photographs, all the video. Everybody knew that he was a part of that OAAU. They had sign-in for the registrations and so forth. And so it was clear that had they wanted him to testify about everything he saw firsthand, he could have, but they never did that. And we think that is more telling than anything.
Very quickly, Ben, before we move on to another subject about where you are right now, you're a Florida resident, wanted to ask you about the state of the lawsuit. You are suing federal authorities, CIA, FBI, New York State, New York City, the NYPD, talking about all of those agencies involved. The two men who were exonerated, although they'd served decades in prison, one dead, one still alive, have settled for millions of dollars. Will you be able to use information based on their settlement for the in pursuing this $100 million settlement for the Shabazz family?
We believe, Amy, we will be able to use a lot of the discovery that the great lawyers with the Innocence Project, Barry Sheck and others, used to help exonerate those individuals and help them get their compensation, because the concealment affected their liberty, but it also affected Betty Shabazz's inability to be able to bring a wrongful death lawsuit for the assassination, the conspiracy to assassinate her husband, the minister Malcolm X.
Ben, I wanted to ask you, Juan, did you have another question on the Malcolm X assassination?
No, go ahead, Amy.
All right, let me introduce the clip, and this is in Florida. I want to switch topics and ask you about the Republican presidential contender, your governor, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's doubled down on the Florida Board of Education's new rules that require educators to teach students that enslaved black people, quote, develop skills which in some instances could be applied for their personal benefit. On Friday, Governor DeSantis defended the curriculum.
I think that they're probably going to show some of the folks that eventually parlayed, being a blacksmith into doing things later in life. But the reality is all of that is rooted in whatever is factual. They listed everything out. And if you have any questions about it, just ask the Department of Education. You can talk about those folks. But, I mean, these were scholars who put that together. It was not anything that was done politically.
The NAACP has called Florida's new curriculum a, quote, sanitized and dishonest telling of history of slavery in America. And, Ben Crump, the last time you were in New York at the Audubon Ballroom, you were threatening to sue DeSantis in the state of Florida. He's talking about what he calls, really, the upside of slavery.
Yeah, Amy, it's deplorable. It is sickening. It is astonishing that in 2023, we could have a person who is the second in contention for the Republican nomination telling his supporters and his state that he governs that it is going to be mandated now that students in Florida, starting from middle school on, will have to be taught that slavery had positive benefits. And it is asinine on every level. It has the potential to cause serious psychological trauma to African-American students. And we will not stand for it. We will explore every possible legal remedy in the court of law. I know activists, civil rights leaders, ministers, business leaders, all throughout the black community who will fight in the court of public opinion against this heresy. It is akin to trying to teach the next generation, the young people, that slavery was not that bad. And if we don't teach our children true history and they don't learn from the sins of the past, then it is very likely that we will repeat those horrors. And we will not allow that to happen.
And Ben Crump, we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you also about another mushrooming scandal of Northwestern in the Northwestern University athletic program. You represent Lloyd Yates, a former quarterback and wide receiver with the Northwestern football team. Could you talk about the importance of what's happening there?
Yes, Lloyd Yates, a courageous young man, who was the quarterback for the Northwestern University football team, whose coach, Fitzgerald, has been fired amidst this hazing scandal, was the first named plaintiff to file a lawsuit, the first person not to stay behind anonymity, but put his name and face out there, launching what I believe wanted to be the Me Too moment for college sports, that we hopefully will eradicate this physical, psychological, and Laura's case, and many others at Northwestern, sexual hazing. And it's no way they can justify this. It needs to be condemned and not condoned in any manner. And we believe, just like with the sexual abuse scandals at Michigan State and Ohio State, that Northwestern needs to step up and set a precedent for what will not be tolerated.
Civil rights attorney Ben Crump, we thank you so much for joining us. Was in New York yesterday, today in Miami, Florida. That does it for our show. Congratulations to Igor Moreno on the birth of his daughter, Alicia Anya Moreno Camarena. Welcome to the world, Alicia. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for interns in our archive and development departments. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Wernoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. To see transcripts and our video and audio podcasts of each show, go to democracynow.org, as well as our extended interview with Isabel Allende. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Follow us on social media at CJSF on Twitter, on Facebook and Instagram at CJSF Radio. Listen to old episodes and special programming on our SoundCloud at CJSF 90.1. Diverse, independent, and yours.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.